In 1861, the first year of the American Civil War, a religious organization known as the American Tract Society began publishing a collection of religious texts, moral tales, and military biographies under the series title, The Soldier's Pocket Library. The production of these books, each of which measures barely 11 centimeters top to bottom, reflected a growing demand for small, easy-to-carry books prompted by the war's outbreak. As a Tract Society distribution agent, or colporteur, would report from a military camp that next year, "The soldiers positively will read anything. I never before knew what it was to see men crave reading." What happens when we scale objects to the pocket? The pocket library's small, lightweight books were convenient for overburdened soldiers, who on average carried personal equipment loads weighing 23 kilograms. But the American Tract Society's decision to publish such little books also reflected more complex concerns about what and how soldiers read. Tract Society agents enthused that pocket library books would allow a soldier to, at any time, put the book in his pocket and resume the reading when opportunity offered. By 1865, the last year of the war, colporteurs would claim that the little books in the pocket library have an immediate effect on the soldiers, causing them to love to be private, redeeming all the time they can for meditation. In the eyes of the Tract Society, the physical design of pocket library books, and what this design encouraged soldiers to do, went hand in hand with the book's improving textual content. If you've ever used a heavy book as a doorstop or put a thin pamphlet underneath a wobbly table leg, you'll know that what publishers construct books to do and what readers actually do with their books isn't always the same. As the Soldier's Pocket Library reminds us, however, design decisions that affect how books look and feel inevitably interact with publisher predictions about reception and use. What print historians might refer to as the format of a book, or its shape, size, and general material design, can thus offer a window on broader cultural values, hopes, and anxieties. From small books developed for use by Civil War soldiers, we can learn a large amount about narratives that shaped a tumultuous period of 19th century American life.
Mikroform. Der Podcast des Graduiertenkollegs Kleine Formen.
We have just listened to Madeline Zander. Madeline is a trained literary scholar. Her research covers book history, material culture, and 18th and 19th century American literature. After finishing her master's degree and PhD at the University of Virginia, she's currently a postdoctoral researcher at Humboldt-Universität zu Berlin and a member of our research group, Kleine Form. We took a recent article by Madeline as an opportunity to sit down with her and talk about her work. Madeline is joined by two members from the research group, Johann Gartlinger and Marvin Renford.
Hello, Madeline, and welcome to our conversation. My name is Marvin.
I'm Johan, and we are very happy to have you on the podcast, Madeline.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
To start our conversation, I would like to come back to something you already mentioned in your introduction, the overburdened soldiers and their very heavy personal equipment. How did soldiers carry their belongings during the US Civil War? What was inside their pockets or backpacks, and who decided on its content?
Military officials, so military officers during the Civil War, often were able to carry their belongings in trunks, but enlisted soldiers had to carry everything on their bodies. And so they did this in a number of ways. They carried knapsacks, and they also were able to carry objects in their uniform pockets. Uniforms at this time were non-standardized, so everyone's, uniform jacket looked a little bit different. extant jackets that are stored in archives and museums sometimes show that soldiers added their own pockets. So there was really kind of a desire to maximize the ability to carry things. What people carried in their pockets depended, you know, from soldier to soldier. We know that people carried personal items like daguerreotypes of loved ones, letters, books, but people also carried things like playing cards that they used to entertain themselves in camps and during long periods of waiting.
In your introduction, you also referred to the soldier's pocket library, and you said that this is a collection of different kinds of texts like religious texts, moral tales, and military biographies. Could you elaborate on these different kinds of pocket-sized books?
During this period, soldiers are reading lots of different kinds of materials, newspapers, magazines, books. And in the space of kind of book reading, most popular are these small books that are sized for carrying. And lots of different publishers decide to publish in this kind of format category of the pocket-sized book in order to meet soldier demand. And this means that you have both religious and reform publishers, such as the American Tract Society, publishing things like little Bibles, sermons, health advice books. But you also get secular publishers who publish things like songbooks or novels, or also, you know, pieces of pocket-sized pornography. And so this kind of heterogeneity of genres that is visible when you look at these pocket-sized print objects designed for use by soldiers leads into a set of concerns that people at the time have about what soldiers are reading. And particularly for military officials and these reform organizations, there's a fear which comes out of a kind of general 19th century fear that reading the wrong thing will have physiological effects, so that reading immoral texts will somehow affect the body. And so with things like dime novels, which were these kind of thrilling tales, sensational tales that really see a kind of publishing boom during this period, people like representatives of the American Tract Society get really anxious that reading too many of these texts is going to make soldiers less disciplined, less able to kind of look after their own bodily appetites. And this in turn leads to larger worries that people have about how you're going to manage these huge, huge armies across really vast geographies.
We will come back later to questions of these pocket-sized books as, so to say, management tools of these groups of soldiers. But before, I would like to get a better understanding of the book's circulation. How did they travel and get into the hands of US soldiers during the Civil War? And what underlying infrastructures facilitated their circulation?
Yeah, a great question. And I should add that the books and materials that I'm focusing on were really designed for use by Union soldiers, so people who were part of the US Army rather than the Confederate Army. And there are a couple reasons for this, but one is that the South is early in the war kind of cut off from Northern centers of print production. People in the Union Army, so the US Army, on the other hand, have access to special low post office rates for sending mail. There are new mail trains that are introduced around the start of the war that also mean that soldiers can still get relatively quick access to print. And you also have people who are working as independent or organizationally affiliated print agents. So the American Tract Society, which I've mentioned, deployed a series of paid agents to go out into camps and carry books with them and sell them or distribute them for free to soldiers. And then the other kind of big piece of infrastructure in this story of wartime print circulation and access are hospitals. So when soldiers are wounded, they have a lot of downtime. And organizations, including the U.S. Sanitary Commission, which was a civilian reform organization, went to a lot of effort to make sure that hospitals were well supplied with libraries. And a kind of interesting thing about this is that In the case of the libraries, this means that we have some record of what soldiers were actually reading.
As a secondary scene, the hospital might be one of these places that is initially overlooked. But as you have pointed out before, it holds quite valuable historical information about the experiences of Civil War soldiers. Pocket-sized books have another unexpected effect in the context of the hospital. Why did they serve as identification tools as well?
The US military doesn't introduce standard issue military ID tags, or what people sometimes refer to as dog tags, until the early 20th century. This means that during the Civil War in the 1860s, people find kind of alternative ways to identify themselves and to identify the bodies of soldiers who've died on the battlefield. One kind of surprising function of these books that soldiers carried in their pockets for sentimental reasons or reasons of entertainment is that they also double as ID badges. And there are numerous accounts of people from hospitals or aid organizations identifying people on the battlefield via an inscription in a book. Publishing organizations, including the Maryland Bible Society, even introduce things like book plates that have a kind of pre-printed blank that can be stuck into a pocket-sized testament. And a kind of more extreme example of this is a little book that I encountered during my archival research, which was called just The Soldier's Book. And it's actually a book that kind of folds up, so it kind of collapses in on itself to be able to fit into a pocket. And it also has these pre-printed blank forms that encourage soldiers to fill out, you know, their weight, their height, who they want to have contacted in case of illness or death. And there's, I think, a kind of interesting way in which these uses of books as ID tags anticipate a more modern use of portable objects and wearables to kind of track the body.
In your article, you also talk about some sort of biopolitical power or influence that can be stated. Was the idea of shaping the soldiers' bodies and minds through those little textbooks intentional? What kind of disciplinary power did they have, and why is the smallness of the books also important to consider here?
The fact that you have both, you know, health advice books and religious texts published in pocket format, and songsters, dime novels, kind of sensational literature, demonstrates that small books in and of themselves are not necessarily tools of biopolitics. What I'm interested in, though, is how the kind of material affordances of small books that can be carried close to the body fuel biopolitical narratives about managing individuals, managing populations. The example that opened this episode, right? So this idea that books in the soldier's pocket library will somehow cause soldiers to meditate, will cause them to love to be private, reflected this hope on the part of reform organizations that if you could get the right text into soldiers' hands, the material form of these books, of these little books, might encourage the formation of certain kinds of reading habits. And again, it's not to say that the pocket-sized book automatically makes us read more frequently, but you can see the ways in which the kind of material form of the book encourages people to imagine that a small book that's carried in a pocket will be read more often and will thus lead to a kind of regular practice around reading. The pocket-sized book has a kind of infiltrating quality, and that it's sort of small. Maybe you don't notice it. The Tract Society, for example, publishes all of these narratives, which they claim are true. Whether or not that is actually true is up for debate. But they publish these narratives in which soldiers are sitting at a gambling table, playing cards, and a Tract Society distributor will come to this table and toss onto it to some small books that are, you know, the size of the cards themselves. Soldiers in these narratives pick up the small books, kind of not realizing that they're not playing cards and then are kind of automatically, you know, they see the light, right? And that's obviously a kind of fantasy, but it's a fantasy that's anchored around the book as a material object.
It seems like there's a tension between the narrative of pocket-sized books as objects with infiltrating qualities, as you phrase it, and some sort of disciplinary power, and at the same time, pocket-sized books as emancipatory tools to gain knowledge, reflection, education. How would you explain these maybe conflicting effects of the mobilization of print products?
So the increased mobilization of print means that more people get access to things to read. We see that by the end of the war, literacy rates have risen. And there are also many narratives that feature uses of pocket-sized books in particular, in which the kind of concealability of a little book leads to really kind of powerful, you know, freedom-supporting effects. And one prominent example in 19th century America can be found in Frederick Douglass's slave narrative, where he talks about carrying a small spelling book in his pocket. And whenever he has a moment as an enslaved child, he pulls this out and kind of works on his reading. But at this time, he's enslaved by a woman who, as he writes in his narrative, gets really, really angry whenever she sees him, you know, carrying any kind of print materials. And so here, the kind of concealability of a small book, the very thing that makes reform organizations so nervous when it comes to soldiers reading things like dime novels, actually has a very powerful and emancipatory effect in that it is a format that supports a reading practice that has to be very adaptable.
After this closer look at Madeline's engagement with pocket-sized books, we turn to more abstract questions. The big questions concerning the small formats, so to say.
In your research, you interpret format as social agreements that rather set people, texts, and things in relation than impose certain practices. Maybe you could elaborate on this understanding of format, what becomes visible when we not only focus on a book's material design, shape, and size.
Format is a concept that has a really long history. It's something that in kind of common English-speaking use during, for example, the period that I'm looking at, the 19th century, people use basically to refer to shape and general size. A little bit later, bibliographers, so people who study books as physical objects, come up with this idea that format as a term is something that you really use to describe the way that pages on the printing press are configured. In my research, I have taken a cue from scholars like Meredith McGill, who look at that bibliographical definition and say, well, format is not necessarily just about how you configure pages on the printing press. It's also, in a kind of theoretical way, about the decisions that publishers are making that are anticipating reception in some kind of way. So going off that, I have been interested in the ways that material artifact interacts with these larger cultural narratives and practices, because you can't anticipate reception unless you have some sense of what your audience is going to do. And so those things are always kind of symbiotically working together. Another thing that I'll add here is that when we take up format as a kind of scholarly lens, it becomes possible to compare different kinds of texts that, for reasons of audience or genre, we might not normally put together. So I think it is a little unusual that you might consider a Bible and a dime novel together. But going by the format, you see that these are both texts that are directed toward this particular audience, Civil War soldiers, and you're able to see, for example, in the case of these reform publishers, that a text, in addition to being formatted to circulate in a certain way, can also be kind of formatted after and against another genre.
I found it very interesting that you just said that there are like oppositions that come together when you look through a certain lens, like format, and then dime novels and the Bible will come together in one perspective. You're describing the small also as a tool of navigating or moderating life in a vast country with an expanding population. And to frame this in a short and open question, what role does the big play in your research?
The big, in some ways, is a category that motivated this entire research project. Narratives of vastness are very dominant in 19th century and 18th century American literature. You have, for example, President Thomas Jefferson writing texts about how animals in America are bigger than those in Europe, right? So he's fighting these narratives about degeneration. People really turn to the language of large scale things and vastness in order to kind of amp up America's importance as, you know, a young country. And reading these narratives in graduate school, I started to become curious about the role of the small. In British literature from this same period, there's much more established discourse around the miniature as a category, for example. So I started to kind of go looking for places that the small was showing up in 19th century American life. And one of the places that I found it was in print culture. Something that has emerged as a result of doing this research is a sense in which these narratives of the vast are really predicated on the small and the portable. In the case of the Civil War, I mean, this is, you know, just an immense conflict. There's so many soldiers deployed. They're really scattered across a vast geography. And small books, particularly the small book's ability to travel or perceived ability to travel along with individual soldiers, comes out of a material reality, but invites these hopes and anxieties around the possibilities of managing a scattered population. So that's another place where big and small are really operating in conversation with each other.
I would love to hear more about how the smallness of the format relates or doesn't relate to the length of the text, because it seems like the pocket-sized books didn't necessarily privilege shorter texts. For example, the Bible or longer novels are not the typical small or short forms. Are there changes of content or of sentence structures noticeable? With shorter sentences, abbreviations, maybe pictures that relate to the smaller format?
The relationship between format and content is absolutely another place that smallness and bigness kind of come into conflict. Certainly, you see published in pocket-sized formats, yeah, long things, right? Long novels. There is also, though, I would say, a kind of significant subset of pocket-sized books that are compilations, so collections of excerpts maybe gathered from other sources and distilled into this kind of small and handy format. One thing that becomes clear in another part of my project, so this is the part of the project that's looking at small books in the American West, is that there is also a relationship between smallness, shortness, and kind of the speed of reading time. And so this is less visible in the Civil War context, where the emphasis is really on getting soldiers to spend their time reading. But in the case of settler colonial agents, including missionaries who are heading out into the West, many of the guidebooks and texts that are developed to help them move across these unfamiliar spaces explicitly say things like, you know, I can't describe all of the West to you, but I'm going to give you just enough so that you can get on your way and move really quickly. And so that elision or, you know, the choice to be selective and to tell people that you're being selective about what information you include serves a kind of sense of urgency, of speed, that of course has kind of ideological implications for American expansion.
For us as young researchers, and probably for our interested listeners as well, it would be great to know how you reconstruct these uses or practices of pocket-sized print materials. How would you describe your methodological approach?
My project reconstructs historical practices of book use in a number of different ways. So I look both at narratives of use. So these are things like what soldiers write in their diaries or their letters. Also accounts like newspapers that describe scenes of soldiers reading. And in addition to narratives, I also look at physical evidence. And so this includes things like marginalia or what soldiers write in their books. I found books, for example, that soldiers wrote little messages in and sent back home to their families. And that is an indication, for example, that the book has value not just as a text, but as a kind of sentimental token or even a kind of, you know, ambassador object, right? So it's helping keep people connected across a long distance. Other details include things like book covers. So for example, there is one publication that includes both a note from a soldier that he read this book while stationed at a fort in Tennessee, and the cover has also been hand-stitched back together by the soldier, we think. So, you know, again, evidence that these books were really being used. They were not just being preserved, but they underwent some pretty difficult conditions. And one further piece of evidence in that vein are the many pocket-sized books that actually have pieces of bullets or bits of shrapnel in them. So real clear evidence that they were carried in the places that soldiers were going. You know, it's always difficult to know exactly what historical readers are doing, and that's certainly a big challenge of this project.
Format also plays a central role in the book you're currently working on. Could you give us a glimpse into what we can expect from your forthcoming publication?
So my book project is about the different ways that people in 19th century America react to pocket-sized books and what these reactions tell us about reading culture and practices of reading. The book begins with a exploration of what portability means as a concept to people at this time, then moves from there to think more specifically about pocket-sized books in kind of two main ways that divide up the manuscript. So the first half of the book is interested in narratives that emerge around the pocket-sized book's perceived mobility, so its ability to be carried with you and to move quickly across space. And so this is where, for example, I'm looking at the role of small books in settler colonial narratives about settling the American West. The second half of the book looks more closely at narratives that relate to the fact that books can be carried very close to the body. Questions of intimacy become more important there. And I look, for example, at how the pocket-sized book acquires this association with habit, first by looking at small books designed for use by children. And then I look at the ways those assumptions, hopes around books as sort of engines of habit show up in these anxieties about soldier discipline and behavior and health during the Civil War. The book ends by looking at a single artifact. So this is a pocket-sized edition of the Emancipation Proclamation, and it models an experiment in what happens when we let format guide historical and scholarly inquiry, and is a way of kind of bringing these threads about both space and population together.
Thanks a lot for the insight into your research.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This book project by Madeline has the promising working title Made to Move: Pocket-sized Print and the Management of 19th Century America. For now, we highly recommend the article mentioned before. It is entitled Adapted to the Soldier's Pocket: Military Discipline, Religious Publishing, and the Power of Print Format During the US Civil War. It was published in spring 2024 in Book History and is available via Project Muse.
Johan Gadlinger and Marvin Renfort conducted the interview. It was moderated by Marie van Bummel. Ana Maria Orjuela Costa, Marvin Renfort, Johan Gadlinger, and Marie van Bummel developed the questions. Marvin Renfort took care of the editing.
Mikroform. Der Podcast des Graduiertenkollegs. Literatur und Wissensgeschichte kleiner Formen.